mention a few things kind of organizationally. First of all, committee, to introduce you to our administrator, Matt Shields, who is related to somebody else who's on the committee. But feel free to access his knowledge and expertise anytime you want on any issue. He doesn't work for me. He works for the committee, and I want you to be comfortable with that, that you work with him on any of these issues. Also, Kate Lowry will be helping us out, so if you have any questions and on anything, please feel free to work with her. There's a lot of people in the room that I have a feeling will be seeing them on a lot of these committee hearings. And so to anybody in the audience, if you have any specific issues as we address our land use system, address Measure 37, you want a particular concept discussed, whether it's in the context of a bill or just in general, feel free to let me know or let Matt Shields know, because I'd be happy to put it on the agenda and discuss it. If it's something that we in the legislature ought to be looking at, I'd be happy to put it on the agenda. With that, I want to talk about kind of where we're going in general on Measure 37, and so that people in the committee know and the audience knows in general. And part of this came up during the hearing we had on Monday, was the voters approved Measure 37 by 61%, and they were obviously did so with a purpose. In my opinion, we haven't addressed a lot of the simmering discontent with the land use system for a long time. And is what I want to do, both in the hearing today and in subsequent hearings, is address some of that discontent, address some of the reasons people have been frustrated with the system and the reasons they voted yes on Measure 37. That brings us to a lot of record. This has been a long issue, and so I just want to have a discussion of the lot of record issue today. Certainly there are bills that will be introduced on this on the House side. Maybe we'll have bills on the Senate side. So even though we don't have a bill before us on the lot of record, I have no doubt that at some point during this session we will see bills on the lot of record, and so what we're talking about today will still certainly be useful in analyzing those bills. I think we have signed up on the list. We're going to start with Ron Eber of DLCD to give us some background on lot of record. Then I'd like to hear from Harlan Levy from the Realtors to talk about his legislative concepts and what he'd like to see the legislature do this session on lot of record. And then we'll just open it up to audience. Testimony from the audience. And both for Mr. Eber and Mr. Levy, I'd like to know, just from my own knowledge, we're going to go through the background of the lot of record. What's the history of it, but also what does it mean now in the context of Measure 37? What would you have us do, or what's the impact of Measure 37 on the lot of record issue? So with that, if you could come forward, Mr. Eber, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Eber. I'm the Farm and Forest Land Specialist with the department. And with respect to lot of record issues, I've been involved with discussions at the legislature on this since, I think, at least 1981. You had asked me to try and give you some background and history, so I tried to put together a packet that provides the information that could help the committee look at this issue. It's an issue that's been around. Whether or not dwellings should go on every lawful lot or parcel, or on lawful lots and parcels that an owner acquired during a certain period of time, or whether or not it's entitled to build if at the time the lot or parcel was built you could build a dwelling, or created you could build a dwelling, or when the owner acquired it it was permissible, have all been discussed over time. I'll quickly summarize, I won't read this, but the packet includes some history with regard to the lot of record discussion, starting in 1981 with a letter from then Governor Attia explaining some of the dilemmas and the trade-offs. There are people who buy property to develop. There are also people on the other side of the property line who buy property for farm and forestry purposes and make an investment in reliance that there would not be conflicting development next to them. So there are equities to all folks. There was a lot of record law that was passed in 1981. and expired in 1985, and approximately 30 dwellings were approved under those provisions before it expired, and a report that we did at that time, a copy of that law is in your packets as attachments 2 and 3. In 1983, the Marginal Lands Act once again tried to address this issue by designating or setting up a process for identifying marginal lands, and then within those areas, all lots or parcels could get a dwelling. It also created a separate provision in the farm statute that allowed parcels less than 3 acres to, under certain circumstances, to get a dwelling. However, that was only usable by counties if they decided to use and designate marginal lands, because it was an optional system, and only Lane and Washington counties exercised that option. So that provision, that which is now currently in 215, 213, subsections 4 to 8, only works in those two counties. Unfortunately, the reporting that we get, I don't have any real accurate numbers of what's been approved in those two counties under those provisions, but I don't believe that it's been a great deal. To the current law, that was passed in 1993 as part of House Bill 3661, and as I note, that was a compromise bill. It required the Land Conservation and Development Commission to repeal its small-scale resource land rules and in return put in place the current lot of record provisions. Again, if the existing marginal lands counties, Lane and Washington, retained their ability to designate marginal lands, then they could not avail themselves of the lot of record provision. So the current lot of record law is not now in use in Lane and Washington counties. The current lot of record law, which starts at attachment 6, basically provides that if someone acquired a lot or parcel that was created prior to January 1, 1985, on non-high-value farmland, they can get a dwelling per some other provisions. The 1985 date was chosen because that was the point in time all the land use plans had been acknowledged by the state, and it was felt that those folks that had property before that and before the rules were changed under the land use system at the time should in some cases be entitled to get a dwelling. And that from that point forward, it was known that the state's land use system was in place, and people were on notice that when they purchased property, there were certain restrictions that were applicable. The other aspect of that, the lot of record law works in both farm and forest lands. In farmlands, it's pretty straightforward on not high-value farmland, and it's more restrictive on the high-value farmland. As I note, there have been about 983 lot of direct record dwellings that have been approved since 1993, which is about 14% of all the dwellings that have been approved in farm zones. And if you look at attachment 7 in your packet, it lays out the latest numbers on all the different types of dwellings that can be approved in farm zones. And I would note that about 84% of the lot of record dwellings that have been approved are on not high-value farmland, and about 50% of the lot of records dwellings are on parcels less than 20 acres. In high-value farmland, you can get a lot of record dwelling if one can show that the land cannot practically be managed for farm use by itself or in conjunction with other land due to some extraordinary situation or circumstance inherent in the land. Or there's something in the Willamette Valley that we refer to as the perimeter test. If you have a parcel less than 21 acres and 67% of your parcel has adjacent parcels less than 21 acres, you can also get a lot of record dwelling. About 156 or 16% of the lot of record dwellings have been approved on high-value farmland, and the rest of the numbers are in there. Originally, the dwellings on high-value farmland had to be approved by a hearings officer from the State Department of Agriculture. and they would make the determination on whether or not the land was could practically be managed for farm use. In the ones they reviewed, they did not determine that any were eligible, and in 1985 the law was changed and that authority went back to the counties for doing that review. You can also get a lot of record dwelling on forest land when it's less productive forest land. Of the 494 lot of record dwellings that have been approved in forest land, about 13% have been in forest zones. And again, attachment 8 shows all the different types of dwellings that can be approved in forest zones and what part of that is from the lot of record dwellings. The distribution of the approvals has been fairly uniform around the state, with the exception of the coast. About a third have been in the Willamette Valley, a third in southern Oregon, and about a third in eastern Oregon, and about 4% of the approvals have been in coastal counties. We have more detailed information by county and by year and by type of lot of record dwelling that have been approved. If the committee wanted more information on that regional distribution, it is available, and also with regard to parcel sizes. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude. That's a brief summary of the law and the background to it, and with a lot of background information, I'm available at any time to answer whatever questions I can and to assist the committee as you discuss this subject.
Thank you very much. Committee, are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman, you mentioned that Lane and Washington County use the marginal lands system. And I used to be more up to speed on this, but have they had a lot of dwellings go in under that system since they started it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I tried quickly to go back through some of the Farm and Forest reports and figure that out, and I couldn't do it real quickly. The reporting is very incomplete. In the early years, there were not, and that would be in the 80s, there were not many dwellings that were approved either in marginal lands or, as I can tell, under the lot of record provision that was available to them. There were dwellings that were also approved as farm-related dwellings under their standards, but I don't have a complete count of those. I could still try and get that if you'd like that.
I'll leave that to the chair, but it might be helpful.
Any other question?
I just have a couple. It seems to me that by not adopting the system for the marginal lands, the other counties were signaling that didn't really help them that much. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a fair statement. Some counties looked at it and felt that given the criteria, it was complicated, and they didn't think the lands that they felt should be designated as marginal or secondary lands really were identified. And that, of course, led to a great deal of effort starting in 1985 up through 93, where the commission grappled with that issue and developed a system for identifying small-scale resource lands. And finally, with House Bill 3661, it was decided to abandon that, use a lot of record approach, and then, frankly, a number of the standards that were being used for identifying, in quote, secondary lands that the commission had adopted got pulled into House Bill 3661 and are the standards with some modifications that are utilized when someone comes to the counter to get approval for a forest template dwelling or a non-farm dwelling. So, in effect, some of those, rather than up front in a proactive planning mode saying these are the primary lands, these are the secondary lands, which is extremely contentious when you're drawing lines on a map, those standards were put into the ordinances and the regulations, and they apply case by case. And in fact, we have seen that prior to 1993, non-farm dwellings, there were a great many approved in the Willamette Valley on the basis that the land wasn't good for farming, and yet, as we know, the valley is quite good for farming. Under House Bill 3661, there's been a shift, and probably three-fourths of the non-farm dwellings are actually being approved in eastern Oregon.
I see. And I guess the reason for a lot of record in the first place is to try to preserve farmland, to preserve a farm economy. Is that I mean, isn't that the reason to try to restrict the number of dwellings that are going to be placed on farmland?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't say that's the reason for a lot of record. The reason for the restrictions on dwellings in farm or forest land is that it's difficult to determine when the dwelling is directly related to farm or forestry versus for non-farm or non-forest purposes. And as many of the people in the room would tell you, a dwelling for someone who's not in farm or forest activities can cause a lot of conflicts to their activities. So that has always been the issue on whether or not more dwellings should be approved in farm or forest areas. The lot of record law was an attempt to determine those owners of property prior to the time the plans were acknowledged that may have had different expectations and to try and preserve in some way their entitlement to build.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Harlan Levy? I've instructed Senator Beyer that he can't leave the committee because then it's just me, so I've asked him anyway, I'll put it that way.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Harlan Levy, Senior Staff Attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors, and I really do appreciate this opportunity to present testimony regarding a lot of record issues. The term lot of record has really become a legal term of art, or at least a land use planner's term of art in Oregon. It refers to those specific types of homes that are authorized in ORS Chapter 215.700 through 700 through 730. And it's not my intention to get into the actual criteria here. You do have an attachment to the testimony that was submitted by Mr. Eber that goes through that with you. But what I'm here to talk to you about is a little bit the thinking behind why we actually have a lot of record statutes and what we ought to be doing in light of the passage of Ballot Measure 37 to update those statutes. These criteria that allow for the establishment of one of these dwellings was created in House Bill 3661 back in 1993. But the purpose for this was to be a safety valve, was to allow for some landowners whose reasonable investment-backed expectations to build a house had been destroyed by the advent of the statewide land use planning program. I would submit to you that goal was not accomplished with the existing lot of record statutes. The information that we received from the DLCD in their 2003 Farm and Forest Report indicates that between the years of 1994 and 2003, only 970 of these lot of record dwellings have been built on farmland. During the same 9 years...
Excuse me, how many?
970 statewide.
Okay. There it is.
Yes. It's in the chart.
Thank you.
Between the same, in the same 9 year period, only 494 have been authorized on forest zones statewide. So while the intent was to create a safety valve for those landowners, very few have been able to meet the extensive criteria that were created in the statute for this purpose. I can tell you from personal experience, when I was in private practice, I represented a landowner in Clackamas County who should have qualified, but because the county took a very restrictive position in how it interpreted the square area around which his property sat, we had to actually get a bill through the legislature in 2001 that told counties exactly what the definition of a flag lot was. Some of you may recall this bill, and how they ought to be using geometric principles that we all learned in eighth grade to his property when they determined what the center of his lot was. He ultimately did get a building permit, but it cost him many thousands of dollars and many years to get there. And he was one of those folks that should have just been a slam dunk. We believe that some of the frustration, actually much of the frustration that you saw manifested in both Measure 7 and Measure 37's passage, is the fact that people just don't think it's right that they cannot live on their property. I mean, this is something that is unique to Oregon. I've done some research, and I was unable to find another state in the entire country that says a landowner is prohibited from living on his property merely because it's zoned as farmland. This is something that is unique to Oregon. I think one of the problems that we have here in Oregon is we only talk about Oregon. We're afraid to look at some of our sister states. And what I've presented for you is an example. If you look at the back of my testimony, I've attached a press release from the American Farmland Trust, an organization that devotes itself to the protection of farmland across the country, and they are making reference to a little town in upstate New York called Seneca, which is actually pretty close to where I grew up in upstate New York, and has some of the finest agricultural soils in the state of New York and arguably in the entire Northeast. And there, they chose to protect farmland by saying, we're going to have 50-acre minimum lot sizes, which is a reasonable way to do it. However, everybody still gets to live on their property. No matter what the size of your lot, it could be a non-conforming lot of less than 50, or if you wanted to do a partition, you could go no smaller than 50. The bottom line is you're still allowed to build a house on your property. And this was a novel approach for those folks in upstate New York. I also have looked at the Vermont Act 250, which is another very restrictive land use planning program. In many cases, I've heard the Vermont Act compared to Oregon's Act. Vermont has a lot of the same situation that Oregon does, in that they have a lot of agricultural land, a very rural landscape, and they do have people from the urban centers of New York City and Boston wanting to sell their condominiums in Manhattan and basically buy a big house in the country, similar to what Oregon faces with the influx of Californians. And yet, even under Vermont's Act 250, which prohibits rural subdivisions, does not prohibit a landowner from building a house and living on his property. It could be the best farmland in the state of Vermont. They are entitled to one house for themselves and their family. I've talked to some of my counterparts from around the country, about Oregon's land use planning program, and in particular, some of the administrative rules that we've adopted to prohibit people from building homes on farmland. The $80,000 test is one of those administrative rules. And they are just appalled. I mean, it is such a foreign concept around the country to think that the state of Oregon, through an administrative agency, adopts rules that tell landowners they can't build a single house for themselves and their family to live on their own land, even if it's an 80-acre tract of land. It just boggles the mind of these folks. So I would submit to you that now, with the passage of Measure 37, and that in creating a lot of liability for both the state and the local governments that are forced to implement these state rules, now would be the time to actually pass a bona fide lot of record bill that says if you had a right to build a house on your property at any given time in the past, and you are still the owner of that property, you will have that right back. And you are entitled to go forth and get your building permit and build your house. Now, this sounds like a foreign concept in Oregon, but it really shouldn't. I mean, this is the law of the land in 49 other states. If you have land that is just farmland and not subject to other environmental constraints, I'm not talking about land where you can't have a septic system or land that may sit in a floodway. We're talking about land that meets other environmental criteria that we would all agree with, building codes, fire codes, etc. If you meet all those codes, it's a no-brainer that you ought to be able to build a house on your property. I think if this legislature goes ahead and adopts that bill, and we will be bringing such a bill forward, the frustration that led to the passage of Measure 37, I think you will take care of most of that.
Mr. Chair? Go ahead. Thank you. Harlan, isn't that what Measure 37 did?
Measure 37 does several things, Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer. And one of the things it says is that a local government must pay compensation or it is entitled to modify, remove, or not apply the offending regulation. The problem with Measure 37 as drafted is we're not sure that those rights are going to transfer upon sale of the property. We're not sure how local governments are going to implement the ballot measure. We're not sure where the litigation is going to lead. There was a lawsuit filed last week. There's a lot of uncertainty inherent in ballot measure 37. And we're not saying that we should take 37 off the table. All that we are saying is that in addition to 37, there ought to be this other opportunity for clarity and certainty that doesn't require, you know, lawyers to delve into all these legal issues. Just a simple application for a building permit to go forth upon a showing that you had a right at some point in the past, that you had those reasonable investment-backed expectations in the past, and that those expectations were destroyed by a statewide planning goal, by an administrative rule, by an act of the legislature. That's all we're asking for. No planning gimmicks, no criteria. You know, if you look at the existing criteria, it says that you have to have a tract that's less than 21 acres. It says that you have to have owned the property in 1985 or earlier. There's a whole bunch of criteria that just keep raising the hurdle, raising the bar, so that it really doesn't provide the safety valve that it was intended.
You mean those are criteria that exist right now?
Yes, yes.
So right now we do have a minimal lot of record, but it's not as flexible or as broad as you would like.
Exactly, Chair Ringo.
Okay.
The bill that we foresee doesn't have all these criteria. It's just a simple showing that you had the right, and that right was removed at some point in the past.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess that's it. You know, yes, there are uncertainties with Measure 37. There's uncertainties with any statute that gets passed by the legislature, initiative, anything else. Someone can sue, can hold up in court. But the concept of Measure 37 is, you know, quite basically, in my opinion anyway, that if you had a right to build a home or at some time in the past, and that is now gone, you now either get compensated for that loss or you get the right back. I mean, isn't that kind of the farmer view of it?
Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer, that's how we read the ballot measure. The problem is there are some local governments that don't read it that way, that are going to try to undermine it, that are going to do everything they can to not see that outcome that we would agree is the outcome that the voters had intended. The compensation side of things also tends to worry us because if you have compensation, then that's, you know, an excuse for new revenue and new taxes, and we're always concerned about local governments going after new types of property taxes that might, you know, increase the cost of housing. So there's a lot of worries that we have that were, you know, created by the ballot measure. We're not saying that it ought to be undermined. We're saying there ought to be an alternative in place to deal with this particular issue that we think led to its passage.
Okay, I mean, and I don't disagree with that premise, but again, I guess I would go back to, in my opinion, that's basically what Measure 37 did. If you had that right once before, you get it back or you compensate it. And, you know, even if we pass a statute that says clearly a lot of record, if you've got a local government, and I think you already used an example of Clackamas County as they were, you know, overly restrictive in the flag lot thing, even though everybody knew what we thought we did whenever the lot, you know, thing was passed the first time. We had to come back in 2001, as you said it was, in order to repass a bill because some county or some local government someplace was trying to manipulate the meaning of, you know, what a flag lot was. So nothing is without peril and interpretation, correct?
Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer, that's true. That's true. But one of the worries that we have, and I spoke to this issue on Monday, was the transferability problem. There are jurisdictions, as a matter of fact, the state of Oregon, through the DOJ, is asserting that Measure 37 rights do not transfer. So if you were to get a building permit under it, and then you tried to sell that lot, the buyer might not be buying a building permit. The buyer might be buying a lawsuit. The bill that we foresee would clarify that if you get a building permit under a lot of record, a new bona fide lot of record statute, that would be a transferable building permit to subsequent buyer.
Yeah, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I'm not arguing against your bill. It just seems like it would be redundant. And, you know, clearly if the legislature, if we can, in my opinion, if we can clarify transferability of the Measure 37 rights, I think we ought to do it. I don't think we should do it parcel by parcel. I think we should do it. And, you know, that's, you know, I'm in agreement with you, but it seems like it's having to pass the same statute again.
Chair Ringo, Senator Byer, we don't see it as redundant. We see it as parallel.
Just to follow up on a couple items, I mean, you mentioned people that are interpreting the statute in that fashion, maybe certain local governments trying to undermine it. I mean, it isn't fair to say there are land use lawyers that are reading the language and are, regardless of whether they were for or against it, I mean, some of them interpret the transferability issue really as a good faith question to put on the table.
Senator Ringo, you put 100 lawyers in a room, you're going to get 100 different answers.
Oh, yeah.
As to what Measure 37 is.
And they'll all send you a bill.
And they'll all send you a bill, exactly. You're right. It can be read different ways. You know, we can look at the intent. We can look at, you know, the legislative history and the voters' pamphlet. The bottom line is we're never going to know until a court rules on that, which could take years. And if it goes to the Supreme Court, it's going to take time. You know, we're here today to ask that you pass a simple bill that would, at least for this one particular issue, for this one area that has led to so much frustration for rural landowners for so many years, at least give them some relief right now so that they know that the legislature got the message.
Okay. Where are you planning on starting that bill?
Senator Ringo, we're having it drafted right now. I'd be happy to speak with you and this committee once we do have a bill draft. You know, if this committee wanted to introduce it, or if the members, we're open.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that. I've heard people discuss a lot of record in a way that you certainly present it in a way that seems completely reasonable and logical, but I've heard examples where it can be abused, where somebody builds a house, immediately sells it, they go 200 yards away to what is a different tax lot, and they build another house. And could you speak to that, please?
Senator Ringo, sure. We're not talking about in any way changing the minimum lot sizes. The current status of the law is if you have an exclusive farm you zone, in most cases the minimum lot size is going to be 80 acres or 160 acres if it's considered rangeland. A lot of record bill would in no way change that. So what we are contemplating would be one house in every 80 acres, which in my mind is very reasonable, is not urban sprawl, not even close to urban sprawl. It's not a rural subdivision. It is a single house in a rural setting.
It was my understanding that there were farms that were contiguous tracts but consisted of many tax lots. Under your proposed lot or record bill, even though there may be a number of tax lots, you know, 6, 8, 10 different tax lots, only one house could be built?
Chair Ringo, we'd be willing to consider that or put that in the bill in some way to protect against that. The purpose would be for one house.
I understand. Right.
So
exactly.
If that's a concern, we'd be willing to look at language that would prevent those types of abuses. Absolutely.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well, yeah, I guess I don't know that I would agree with your terminology it'd be an abuse. If you currently had, and there are lots of parcels out there like that, a single farm may have, it may be an 80-acre farm that was purchased in four separate purchases, 20 acres each, and they may have happened in the 50s. To have a true lot of record bill, which you're describing, then to say, but the lot of record means one house per 80 acres, you've just taken value away from that person if he purchased that 80 acres in four separate purchases of 20 acres each.
Chair Ringo, Senator Byer, the purpose of this bill is one house. For those people that really had reasonable investment-backed expectations to build a house on their land and had those expectations destroyed by, for example, statewide planning goal 3, to give them that right back. They would still have rights under Measure 37 to go different routes, to do different things. We're looking at getting a bill through this legislature that finally establishes a bona fide lot of record statute with no planning gimmicks and no you know, criteria that are difficult, if not impossible, for landowners to meet. We believe one house is fair, and we think that, you know, the environment that we have today in a post-Measure 37 world, you know, at least let's do something to alleviate this tension.
Mr. Chair? And in the course of proposing this, would you be willing to make sure, possibly strengthen the right to farm provisions that we have? Because a big problem with houses going in is people move out from the city into those houses, and then the farming practices next door, you know, the 3 o'clock tractor rides and the, you know, the herbicides and the fertilizers and everything else, really bother the neighbors, and it has resulted in lawsuits. And there are right to farm provisions to protect working farmers, and would you be willing to add strong provisions for those right to farm measures in your bill?
Chair Ringo, Senator Burdick, there are existing statutes codified, I believe, in Chapter 30 of the ORS that are very strong, and I don't know that I could say that we would be willing to go any further than what's already out there. We think those statutes are already pretty strong. Landowners that choose to live in farm zones have to give up many rights that they otherwise would have to enjoy nuisances, and in fact those statutes have protected farmers from just such litigation over the years. I don't know there's a need to go further than what's already on the books.
Chapter 30.
Yeah, it's ORS Chapter 30.930.
And it, even to continue, Mr. Chairman, there was a very publicized case a few years ago of some dogs getting loose in Bend and killing some sheep, and the. There was a lot of public sympathy for the dogs who were condemned to death row because that's what the statute read. So when urban people move out into the farm area, oftentimes they don't fully consider some of the impacts of what they're doing, which kind of raises another question. When realtors sell property like that, you know, assuming there could be a house on it, what are the disclosure requirements for the buyer? I assume you have to disclose all the provisions of the right to farm.
Chair Ringo, Senator Burdick, yes. In the earnest money agreement, it's in actually in Chapter 93 of the ORS, there's a provision that provides that in every earnest money and every sale agreement, there has got to be a disclosure that talks about right to farm statutes, talks about EFU zones. There's a whole bunch of language in there already that the buyer is on notice. I mean, assuming that they actually read the documents, and they do have a duty to read, it's there and it is disclosed.
Thank you.
Anything further, Senator Byer? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson, do you want to testify on this bill, or are you just here to take in the wisdom? Thank you. Let's bring up Mike McCarthy from Hood River County, and I was also wondering whether Sydney Blaine, do you want to testify together?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Chair Ringo, happy to be here today to address the committee. We have some very brief remarks today. Our ride is leaving at 3:45, so
okay.
We're going to be real brief. But I'm a farmer from Parkdale, Oregon, and I farm about 50 different lots in the Upper Hood River Valley, and I raise a number of crops, but I make 95% of my income from raising pears. And I think we'll try to come to a number of sessions here when you discuss Measure 37. Hopefully we'll be meeting with you again and attending some more of the hearings, and as well on a lot of record. And our comments are going to be fairly brief today. You talked about some simmering discontent about the land use system in Oregon, while I certainly, as a farmer in the farm zone, have my own simmering discontent about the land use system in Oregon, and I don't believe there's been nearly enough done to protect the farm zone for farmers that really are serious about farming. And I think that's we need to divide farmers into two categories, maybe those that want to get out of farming and those of us that want to farm. And those of us that want to farm feel there's far too many dwellings in the farm zone. The farm zone in Hood River County, the average lot size is, or parcel size is 12 acres, which is much too small to farm efficiently. We don't need any more parcels. We're kind of at a turning point where we need to decide in Hood River County whether we're going to have a try to still have an industry and have a globally competitive pear industry, or where we're going to give it up. And a lot of that depends on the decisions you make, not the decisions we make. Some of us are committed to farming. If we couldn't make it farming pears, we'd make it farming something else. For me personally, as I said, I make 95% of my income from farming pears, and I've made a profit every year since I started in 1980. And people that aren't making a profit in farming probably wouldn't make a profit in anything. And in the pear industry in Hood River County right now. And I know that's a strong statement, but pear industry's been pretty good to me. I went to college for a long time, got 3 degrees in agriculture. I've always been a student of agriculture. I like agriculture. That's what I want to do. That's what I'm committed to. And I believe there's a long future for agriculture in the Hood River Valley, but we can't divide it all up in two-acre parcels and put a lot of record on every single parcel that's out there. And in my own case, I could probably build another 45 homes on my farm with a lot of record provisions. And to me, that's an awful big hole to have in the system. So with those few comments, I hope you'll protect my rights as a farmer. Right to farm doesn't do it, doesn't begin to do it, and really is pretty useless at this point in Oregon as it's written. And we always, people try to lean on that as something that's going to help us, but it's really pretty useful to somebody that actually farms. So that's my simmering discontent. And I hope to be back and have some discussions with you in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just wanted a couple clarifications. You said you had 50 different lots, and how many acres do you have?
Well, our family altogether has about 1,000 acres in the upper Hood River Valley.
So the 1,000 acres consists of 50 lots?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I...
Yes, go ahead.
Be very brief, Senator Ringel. I'm Sydney Blaine, and my husband and my family and I farm in, have four farms in two counties in Oregon, and we farm apples, pears, cherries, and some beef and sheep. And houses, again, next to our various farms make life really hard for us. You've heard all that testimony before. I've tried to mentally count up how many different parcels we have. We have, I think, 12 or 13 that all could take houses. And the thing is, I called the Hood River Planning Department trying to figure out how many lots of records might actually exist in Hood River County, and no one really knows. I think we have 6,600 tax lots, but lots of record are a very strange thing. I mean, you have to research them. They're very complicated. And so to pass a lot of record law without really fully understanding how many actual building lots you might be possibly allowing would be really, really scary. In Hood River right now with Measure 37, we're looking at suddenly so many subdivisions on high quality, high density farmland. It's going to undermine our economic ability and our viability. So please look into it pretty carefully before you do something. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for me? I just have one question for either of you. You heard the representative for the realtors, Harlan Levy, advocate for a lot of record, but then he also said he would be happy to have a lot of record law that somehow was tailored so it truly was one house instead of one on each lot, so that really we're talking about somebody being able to build a house on their land. Would you find that objectionable?
Excuse me. Again, I think Sydney hit right on the point, and that is, what is the impact of that? You know, we really don't know. And we realize that there is a certain amount of, well, obviously with 37, very much concern about land use in Oregon, but and we're, you know, aware of that, and there's a possibility that there might be some minor modifications that could be made in lot of record, but to plop down more houses in the farm zone in Hood River County is going to be the end for us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let's bring up Carrie McLaren, please.
Thank you, Chair Ringo, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie McLaren. I'm a staff attorney at 1000 Friends of Oregon. I appreciate very much the opportunity to speak with you here before today, and hopefully my conceptual comments will help to draw out some of this discussion, and I would be happy to provide any follow-up information that the committee finds necessary. As I was listening to the orchardist from Hood River County speak, it struck me that we need to know a little bit about what is happening on the ground in Oregon agriculture, and I'd like to provide a bit of background with respect to that. We did a mapping project in 1995 in Washington County and looked at all the development that had occurred on tax lots in Washington County at that time. That indicated that there actually was really not a lack of supply of houses, shall we say, in farm zones, but rather an oversupply. There is one house for every 33-acre zoned EFU in Washington County, one house for every 12-acre zoned EFU in Hood River County. And yet the average size of a farm that's grossing more than $10,000 a year, which sort of cuts out the hobby farmers and starts to look at people who typically may start turning some sort of profit on their farm, is 169 acres in Washington County and 75 acres in Hood River County. This is similar in parts of the state that we have been able to analyze. Jackson and Marion counties, for example, there are about seven houses for every farm grossing more than $10,000 a year. In addition to converting farm parcels directly to residential uses, residential encroachment into traditional farming areas sets off a series of negative effects for agriculture. Land prices tend to escalate, costing farmers more when they seek to expand or modify their operations. Neighbors complaining about noise, odor, hours of operation, increased traffic makes it very difficult to move farm equipment. One of the things that I would point out in this conversation is that many farmers farm, and Mike McCarthy spoke of this, non-contiguous parcels of farmland, or Sidney Blaine talked about farming in several different counties. It's necessary for farmers to get sometimes rather large machinery through there, and they depend upon farm-to-market roads for being able to manage their operations. Obviously, at the end of the day, the amount of farmland available for farming impacts the critical mass of farmland and therefore the infrastructure and support services necessary to support a viable agricultural operation. Mr. Eber talked about the history of House Bill 3661 and the authorization for lot of record dwellings, which essentially allows landowners who have owned their property since 1985 to build a house on one tract of land, one house per one tract. There is not a minimum lot size requirement for building that, except for if you are on high-value farmland. The 25% of our agricultural land base that is the most productive in terms of being able to support high-value crops.
And that lot size is 20?
Senator Chair Ringo, it's referred to use another term of art, as the perimeter test, a subdivision of the lot of record provisions, which essentially says that if you have a lot that is less than 21 acres in size, that is surrounded by in its perimeter by a number of other small dwellings, also small parcels, also with houses, that you are allowed to have a lot of record dwelling, despite the fact that it may be located on high-value farmland.
And if it's not high-value farmland, then there's no minimum lot.
Chair Ringo, that is correct. I just wanted to provide you, and this is but one example of regions around Oregon, and I'll be my own Vanna here, which
you
you help her?
Somebody else can be my vanity. You could just hold that up a little bit. We need to actually. Sorry. Keep on going. Upside down. Thank you. This is a map of Washington County. The exclusive farm use zones are in the darker green and the lighter green shades. Again, this uses tax lots, which is not an absolute proxy for parcels, but is a good one. And what it demonstrates is how many houses would be able to be, how many houses there could be in the farm zones in Washington County if we allowed a house on every tax lot. I do understand that Mr. Levy has discussed concepts of where he might go, but this begins to show the impact in Washington County, assuming no other land division since 1985, of what the overall build-out of one house per tax lot would be. Thank you. I told you that when we did this mapping project, the existing dwelling density in Washington County EFU zones was one house per every 33 acres. This development would increase it to one house per every 19 acres. Again, the average farm size in Washington County is 175 acres. That makes it very difficult for commercial agricultural operations to exist. I'm going to just briefly touch, because comments are frequently made with respect to the farm income test and its effect.
Before you get there, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. You heard Mr. Levy testify that he might be amenable to a lot of record bill that was not focused on a lot of record, but somehow ownership of land, for example. So if a parcel contained several lots, they could still only build one dwelling. Right. Would that be okay?
Chairman, I would answer that question in two ways. One, we have a provision for that in ORS 215-700 and following statutes, which authorizes a landowner who's owned property for one tract, which is one or more contiguous parcels, to build a home if they've owned that property continually since 1985. 1985 was selected as a proxy date when in House Bill 3661, from my knowledge, to reflect the fact that was sort of the last date by which counties had begun to adopt their comprehensive plans. Perhaps there was confusion between 73 and 85 as to whether and how dwellings would be restricted or limited on farmland, and so that was chosen as a date to sort of balance the equity provisions of farmers' rights who had made investments in their property and business expectations that they were going to be able to continue to farm, with property owner rights who perhaps anticipated the time that they purchased their property that even if they didn't farm, they would be able to get a dwelling. And so the subsections following ORS 215-700 essentially lay out the conditions under which a person can receive authorization for a dwelling. Beyond that, in answering the question, and again, I don't want to fall subject to the old adage, but it's kind of one of those, the devil's in the details. We do know, and Governor Vicatia's letter, which I actually had not seen before, speaks really quite pointedly about the issue of ancient subdivisions, fruit tract subdivisions, paper subdivisions, whatever you want to call them. I have an example, essentially, of one such one on the back of my testimony. There are many circumstances around Oregon where we had these paper platted, these old subdivisions that I want to say exist in legal fact and exist in paper fact, but with respect to the uses on the land, many of these areas have been farmed and farmed continuously as one unit. There's also then the issue, again, of farmers farming several different non-contiguous parcels. And so I guess my answer to that would be, I think in part we have utilized that several, about 1,500, I think, dwellings have been built under those provisions in the last 10 years. And in terms of expanding that, I have concerns about what that would do to the overall stability of the land base, recognizing that there are numerous parcels out there which are currently supporting family businesses, family farms, and family ranches. A couple of more thoughts, and then I would be certainly happy to answer questions, is The provisions relating to the farm income standards for farm dwellings does not prohibit farmers from being able to build a farmhouse on their property, but rather is an enunciation of what has been a statutory provision since 1973 and before, that it was a dwelling customarily provided in conjunction with farm use that was an allowed use on farmland. On high-value farmland, which is 25% of Oregon's agricultural land base, the standard is $80,000 on your entire farm operation. On non-high-value farmland, it is sort of capped at $40,000. It's lower in some counties with lower median farm incomes. Just for comparative sake, according to the 2002 Census of Agriculture, the average gross income for farms grossing over $10,000 annually is $257,000, which is considerably more than $80,000 in gross sales. Not surprisingly, the farms that the diagram on page 3 shows the percent of farm sales by sales class. Farms that gross less than $10,000 a year account for only 2% of the farm sales in Oregon, whereas farms grossing more than $100,000, again less than the average, produce 89% of the gross farm sales in the state. We have a very strong and very vibrant agricultural economy here in Oregon. It has relied heavily on a concert of protections, including exclusive farm use zoning, somewhat in part right to farm laws, and various processes of the state which have supported that industry. As a result, today Oregon agriculture is a growing industry. It's at $8.7 billion in terms of sort of economic output. 8 to 10% of our gross state product is related to agriculture, ranking it one of the highest in the state. One in every 12 Oregonians works on farms. This is part of our economic backbone, not only in the rural areas of Oregon supporting our family ranches in eastern Oregon, but also in the Willamette Valley, where 4 of the top 5 agricultural counties are close to our highest population centers. I think that's a success. I certainly do think that Measure 37 calls upon us to look at our land use laws, and I hope that we're able to do that in the context of a 30-year review, analyzing the balances of our statewide comprehensive land use planning program. I thank you again very much for the opportunity to speak with you today and be happy to answer any questions.
I just had one question. The $80,000 income test rule, that applies to high-value farmland. I've heard complaints that some of the farmland has just been improperly classified, and people would kick rocks and look at their soil and say, "You call this high value," and that they just can't. You know, it's one thing to apply that test in a great river bottom land in the Willamette Valley, but it's being applied in areas that really just can't be farmed at that level.
So
I guess part of the answer then might be to try to reclassify the land.
And Chair Ringo, there are people are able to seek reclassifications of soils already. I would say that that's actually been an area of concern by farmers, where there aren't, an applicant is able to hire a soil scientist and say, "I can test my soil classification," but farmers certainly don't have a right of access to that property to say, "Wait, we think that soil scientist isn't doing the right job." So I think that, currently today there is the ability certainly to get your soil classified. Is it happening perfectly? Probably not. I certainly have heard complaints that it's not happening perfectly from one end of the spectrum, which is suggesting that some of our good and high-value farmland is being misreclassified to a non-high-value use in order to allow a non-farm dwelling or be able to seek different provisions for building a dwelling on farmland. Another area to look into, but there are certainly provisions already in existing law that would account for reclassification of soil standards.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to bring up a couple folks from Washington County, please. Dave Van Ash and Ellen McNeil. Sorry.
Mr. Senator Ringo, first thing I want to do is thank you for pronouncing my name right. I don't know how you did that.
I couldn't read it, so I guessed.
Senator Ringo and Chair and Senator Beyer, appreciate you allowing us to testify today. I'm Dave Van Ash, and my wife and I own and operate Van Ash Family Farm in Washington County. My family's been there.
Where in Washington County?
Washington County. We're halfway between North Plains and Cornelius, is where our center of operation is at.
Okay.
And we farm land all the way over into the Bethany area. We farm Portland Community College.
I'm trying to understand if you're in my district. But
We farm some land at Portland Community College, and then we go as far south as Gaston area. We're in the Yamhill County just a little bit. Anyway, we've been there since 1896 on the land that some of the land our family owns. Our family actually owns about 630 acres, and we have about 1,700 acres that we lease from about 25 different landlords. And the parcel sizes range from about 1.8 acres to 205 acres. And I need to put on my glasses here, I guess. We're in about 20 different locations. So, you know, we travel down the road a lot. We have our operation is primarily grass seed and legumes. And so we, you know, combine swathers, that sort of thing. Senator Burdick asked a question about dust and noise and conflict. I have those issues at the present time. We've had conflicts with pesticides. The Department of Ag has been out and looked at those conflicts. Wasn't any problem, but we still have people that filed complaints against us. We've had the police out on the edge of the urban growth boundary at night because people think that we just go out and swath grass seed to annoy them in the middle of the night. So we have plenty of conflicts already. And my concern is if we know with the passage of Measure 37, and also this lot of record bill that's going to put more non-farm dwellings into the farm area, and we're going to have more conflicts. And I want to go back to about 1970. I was just getting out of college. Had a choice of either farming or engineering, and I became an engineer because I didn't think that there was going to be any land left to farm in Washington County, because I saw it being developed into five-acre tracts and a lot of urban sprawl. And Senate Bill 100 changed all that. And I came back to the farm in 1980, and I and my wife have bought 480 acres since 1980, most of it in the 90s. And the frustrating thing about Measure 37 is it doesn't give equal treatment to everyone. The land we've bought, we're not eligible to do anything with it with most of it, because all the rules in place occurred after we purchased. We have land in the family that my mother owns that's eligible for Measure 37. We don't intend to do any filing because we didn't buy the land to develop it. We bought it to farm it and to make a living off the farm. And our intent, if our family doesn't farm it anymore, is to sell it to another farmer so they can farm it. Oregon does have about a $3.8 billion ag industry, and Washington County, where I live, which is part of the metro area, is number fourth in the state as far as income producing. And one of the reasons why is because of the mild coastal climate we have here in the Willamette Valley. I went to Australia a year ago, and I went to a big international seed conference there with the idea of I wanted to find out where the competition was in the world to learn why I wouldn't be in the seed business in 20 years, because we all know that it's a worldwide economy. And what I learned there from 80 different countries was the only place to really produce grass seed was in Oregon in the Willamette Valley because of its climate. And the only difference between this climate and anywhere and a lot of other locations in the world are the 2 or 3 month months of dry weather we get in the summertime. Everyone else has harvest issues in other places in the world. So we do have a pretty unique type of agriculture here, and we have about 220 different crops we can grow here in Oregon, and particularly the Willamette Valley. And so as soon as we start putting more dwellings, more farm, non-farm uses out into the farm zone, we create more conflicts. And in my case, since I and my wife bought all this land prior to 1972 when the big changes occurred in land use, we're going to have neighbors that are going to file Measure 37 complaints, and if they don't get compensated, they're going to get the waiver, and they're going to start developing their property, and we're going to be trapped because we're still trying to farm, but you know, we have all the conflict issues, and these conflicts are great. I mean, in the summertime when our combines are running, and then afterwards in the months of August and September when we're tilling, have you ever been in the dust cloud, you know, from this equipment? I mean, I do it to my own house, and my wife doesn't like it, but that's the way it is because we live out there and we make our living off the land, and the neighbors put up with it because they're doing other types of conflict activities. So, you know, the wind blows both directions on the property line, but when you're up against non-farm housing, and we have some land that we own out in the rural area that's next to some non-farm housing, those people try to understand, but you know, because they go, well, we sacrifice a little bit here because we do live out in the country, but it still gets down to when the conflicts get bad enough, they complain. And it doesn't matter how much right to farm you build into the law, when those complaints get great enough, they're going to drive people like me out of business. And so that's why I'm here today. And you did mention, you were talking about adding tracts together or one tract out of a lot of tax lots. You know, the $80,000 dwelling standard sort of does that already. There's a the part of that law says that a farmer can go out and add all these tracts together to build a home, and then the tracts that he adds together to create the $80,000, those become unbuildable. So you end up with the one house out of all the tracts that you add together. And then the other thing about the 80,000 is it's not 80,000 everywhere in the state. A lot of the state is 40,000.
Okay.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you.
Chairman Ringo and members of the committee, my name is Ellen McNeil. I'm from Washington County. My husband and I have a Christmas tree farm, like you, Senator Beyer. And
again, I have to ask whether you're in my district. Where are you?
We live in North Plains, and we farm in the Banks area as well as the North Plains, rural North Plains area. And we too are spread out. Our parcels of Christmas trees are within a 25-minute drive of our house, but we farm one that's 29 acres, a 45, a 38, and an 80, and then another piece of 17 that we lease. So we have about 200 acres, and none of those pieces are contiguous. So, and we've owned a couple of them since 82, 92. Theoretically, it sounds like I might be able to build four different houses on those properties under the lot of record concept that was proposed. But the reason I'm here is that I am concerned about additional houses in the farm zone. And in Washington County, we've already seen a lot of that. In the area that I'm in, there are a lot of non-farmers living in the farm zone where we work. And it does make it more difficult to find land to buy or lease. And we've had a really hard time finding suitable ground for Christmas trees that is within a half-hour drive of our home place, which is not on EFU land, by the way, and we're still able to farm without a dwelling on our farm land. But we've had a hard time finding additional land that was suitable for the species that we were trying to grow in a 30-minute drive from our house, because a lot of the land's already parcelized, has a house on it, maybe a little hobby farm, or someone who has their land, maybe they have 20 acres with a horse on it, that type of thing. There's a lot of that in our area. So it's really been hard for us to find enough land to remain viable, to buy or lease. So I'm concerned with more homes in the area that it's really going to be hard for us to survive as farmers. We've been farming since 1980. We do it full-time, and I think as a full-time farmer, it's pretty easy to meet the $80,000 test. And we, like Mike mentioned with his pear operation, we've been profitable every year that we've been in Christmas trees. We think there's a great future for our industry. Oregon, as you probably know, is the leading producer of Christmas trees in the nation. And it's because of the great climate that we have and the soils that we can grow them here. I can't grow them in on the other side of the Cascade Mountains, however. So as the population pushes towards us, it gets a little bit scary whether our industry will survive. And I think the other point I want to make is just the fairness issue, that when we purchased our property, we had an expectation that because it was in the farm zone that we would be able to farm and that we wouldn't be surrounded by rural residences. And I just found out this morning that the neighbor next to one of our properties has filed a Measure 37 claim to convert their 40 acres into 5-acre home sites. So it does make it harder. We have had complaints as well from people about, usually it's about spraying. But it is tough to farm with a lot of rural residences around you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee?
Just one, and I appreciate, you know, especially your testimony, because I'm very similar position. But when you have complaints about spraying or you have complaints about dust, and I was earlier reading through the right of farm laws, trying to figure out, you know, because Mr. Levy said he didn't think we needed to strengthen them, and they do seem pretty clear, pretty strong. And the complaints you've had, either of you, have you ever had any action taken against you? Or anyone tried to take action against you for those complaints?
Well, like I said, I was. We had a pesticide complaint filed against us because this doctor from Portland lived on a piece of property next to a field that we farmed, and she complained of chemical drift. And the day that she complained about that, there was absolutely no wind. It was a perfect day for spraying. And the State Department of Ag came out, and they did about a 50-page report, and they told us before they ever did the report that there wasn't, that they knew what the answer was going to be because they did not see any evidence of spray drift onto her shrubbery and flowers and so forth. We were about, our field was probably 15, 20 feet away from her yard. Mm-hmm. And that was the conclusion, but that cost the state of Oregon a lot of money, and that cost me a lot of frustration. And, you know, every time I still farm that field, and every time I get next to that house, I'm going, oh, what's going to happen here? You know, what kind of a complaint am I going to get? And I think eventually when, you know, we farm out there in agricultural clusters, and neither one of us talked about it, but in Washington County, the infrastructure that's in Washington County, the seed dealers, the equipment dealers, the pesticide dealers, those dealerships serve about 5 counties. They serve Washington County, Yamhill County, a little bit of Multnomah in the Soviet Island area, Columbia, Clatsop, Tillamook, because there's not a large enough ag area in those other counties to support the infrastructure of dealerships. So our county supports those dealerships. And if we lose enough agriculture in our county, those dealerships all move farther south. They move to the Salem area. So then Ellen and I and the rest of our Washington County farmer friends are forced to come down here to buy supplies and sell seed and that sort of thing. And so it puts us at a real disadvantage because we lose our infrastructure. And the less and less farming activity that occurs in Washington County, I mean, that's the reality of the situation. Used to be in Clark County, Washington, there was quite a bit of seed and grain that was grown up there, and it all came to Washington County to be processed before it was loaded on a ship in Portland or whatever, or wherever it was sold worldwide. But they had no infrastructure left up there. They did at one time, but it slowly got removed as Clark County got developed.
Thank you.
Have you had any complaints? I mean, actual, not just complaints. I mean, I understand complaints, but then there's legal action or challenges. Have you read anything?
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, we did get a nasty letter from an attorney of a landlord one time, and that just caused a lot of stress and some legal fees for us, and nothing really came of it, but we were a little nervous about that landlord from then on, and he was one who acquired the property after we signed our 10-year lease with the previous landowner. So you probably, maybe you've run into that before, too.
Yeah. No, you want to try real scary when you get helicopter harvesting and the horses start running around.
Yeah.
That gets scary.
We haven't had any complaints about our helicopter harvesting, fortunately. Most of the neighbors enjoy watching it. But we did get a complaint filed with the state once about helicopters, aerial spraying. That wasn't even us. It was our neighbor who was doing it, but he called in a complaint against us. I think he was just unhappy with us for other reasons, perhaps. So that nothing came of that one either.
Okay.
A couple other comments.
Just briefly.
Okay. My family owns approximately 13 different parcels, different tracts, and we presently have four houses on those. My mother lives in one, I and my wife live in the other, and two of them are rentals because we bought farms that had houses on them. But we're eligible for nine more houses, so I mean, we're not going to take advantage of that through this bill, but it just kind of shows you how many more dwellings could be built mm-hmm. out there. And then another big issue in our area for our operation is moving equipment down the road. Because we are in the metro area, there's just lots of traffic and farm equipment, wide farm equipment, and slow-moving farm equipment is a big issue with traffic in our area. And it seems like somehow during the urban growth boundary process, when cities expand their boundary, nobody looks outside that boundary to see what kind of implications it's going to create in the rural area as far as additional non-farm traffic. So that in itself is a big conflict. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I would like to welcome Senator Shields to our committee. Thank you. And on behalf of the committee, offer our condolences for your father's passing.
Thank you.
So, I'm glad you're back. Peter Carnegie, please.
Chairman Ringo, members of the committee, my name is Peter Carnegie. I farm in North Albany in Benton County. Farm about 350 acres, primarily row crops for NORPAC and various grass seed and native seed, specialty seed stuff. First off, I'd like to second what both the farmers from Washington County and Hood River County said. And without repeating a lot of the information they said, I agree with it. I was actually quite appalled by Mr. Levy's proposal for that wide, wide open lot of record bill. And he used examples of other states as a justification for, you know, the other states do it. Well, I've spent quite a bit of time over the years. My wife's from northern Indiana. I've traveled quite a bit to eastern Pennsylvania, Washington. And, you know, I go to those other places, and I am utterly appalled at the lack of foresight by those governments and how they they just have not preserved their farmland. Their development patterns are just atrocious. And to use those examples as a means to weaken the rules we have to preserve our lands here is just, it just appalls me. You know, one of the things, you need to remember when we start adding additional houses, you know, scattered into farmland on these, you know, lots, is the extra cost that those houses require in services. You know, there's well-documented figures that I'm not quite sure I'll get this right, but for every dollar a rural resident pays in taxes, they require $1.60 in services. And farms pay, don't quote me on that, I'm sure you maybe have heard those figures before. But it's a very inefficient use of property. It costs the cities and the counties, the municipalities, governments extra money. It's not a wise use of resources. Address one other thing that I think gets lost in the whole Measure 37 conversation and the property rights debate that's totally ignored is the responsibility of property owners. You know, what
responsibility do owners have for stewardship? What responsibility do we have to future generations to preserve an efficient, viable agricultural economy? It's that whole piece gets left out when we talk about property rights, and that responsibility needs brought back into the conversation. I also happen to be involved in a number of other things, and one of the I've been on the Benton County Planning Commission now starting my 13th year on that, and I've seen quite a few a lot of records applications and dwellings that have come through Benton County that we've approved. And there's a couple loopholes in our existing lot of record legislation that I think need closed up. One, I think they shouldn't be transferable. If people want, if they, it was my understanding of the original intent, it was to give those people who had bought those parcels expecting to build a house the right to build a house on it. When they go and apply for it and get the permit and then sell it, that house wasn't for them. They're just out trying to make some money. And that's a misuse of the original intent of that lot of record law. And the other loophole is that there's actually a lot of parcels, and I can name a number of them in farm parcels in my area that when you look at what has happened to those parcels over the years, there was a large farm parcel, there was one or two houses on it, those two houses were split off, there was another house added on, it was split off, and so you have these larger parcels that have actually spawned five or six non-farm dwellings. And it just makes absolutely no sense to allow additional dwellings in those kind of situations. That may be enough for now.
Okay. We'll have more discussion about this. Feel free to come in and pitch in at a later time. Any questions?
I'll be back. Thank you.
Committee? Thank you very much. Art Schlack, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. On a day that's like spring, you decided to have a hearing on or a meeting on one of the flashpoints that have been part of Oregon's land use program since the early 1970s. The Association of Oregon Counties has, as you know, has been involved in the Oregon land use planning program since its inception. And we have been involved in a number of discussions with regard to lot of record. Lot of record, let me just share with you a couple of observations about the lot of record discussion. The first thing that I would note is lot of record, when we talk about lawfully created lots of record, because there are a number of parcels out there that were created by simply a farmer going down to the assessor's office, which he can do today, and create a tax lot for the purposes of getting a separate tax statement so that he can, when he leases that piece of property, he gets a separate tax statement so that the farmer can pay the taxes on that piece of property, and he knows that separate and discrete. And that happened historically. So you have a lot of what is identified on the map, such as what Thousand Friends of Oregon showed you in Washington County, of tax lots that may not be lawfully created either through a deed or sales contract historically or through land division regulations that were established, subsequently, that all partitions have to go through. So that's one issue. Another issue that you have when you talk about lots of record is, if we go back in time, and even when we started zoning, historical agriculture and forest zones had a minimum lot size, and it was fairly small. In fact, I remember the first county, couple counties that I worked for, had 2-acre minimum lot size in their F1 zone or their forest zone. So it was a 2-acre minimum lot size, and each one of those zones allowed a house as a matter of right. Now, we, as part of the program, we moved away from that. In the 70s, we moved with the concept of having special taxation for agricultural land, and we set up the fact that if you were in these special agricultural areas and got special tax breaks for being in those classifications and met an exclusive farm use zone, then you had a larger minimum lot size, and people started changing the minimum lot sizes from 2 acres to 38 acres to 76 acres to finally in 1993 the statute said on high value or in the Willamette Valley you had an 80 acre minimum lot size. So you wind up with all these changes, and so one of the questions is, well, how is there a date? Is, if you do a lot of record, is it, and what is usually talked about is two dates. One is 1985, because 1985, by 1985, the 36 counties in the state all had acknowledged comprehensive plans. And so if all counties had the acknowledged plan, and if they had an exclusive farm or forest zone, it was depicted and they'd already zoned the land in accordance with that plan. The other one is 1993, and that goes back to House Bill 3661. That was where we basically established the first concept of a lot of record. It was limited because it was the legislature decided at that time, not to go all the way, but to go in part. During the 2001 legislative session after Measure 7, we had a lot of discussion about lot of record because it was a flashpoint, and it was, I would say, one of the primary reasons why we have Measure 37 now. We had discussion about the dates and about application, about legal lots, but we also had some discussions, and I think it was mentioned here today, about a tract of record rather than a lot of record. A tract of record being if a person had more than one tax lot, that you would get at least one house, regardless of the size, on that one lot that had been lawfully created, or that tract of land. Where we really have the problems in various portions of the state and counties experience this is that you've had small parcels that were created historically, and they're now in an exclusive farm use zone without a home on them. And people believe, rightfully or wrongfully, that since those parcels were created at a time when you could put a house on those as a matter of right, that you still should be, that they should have that right today. I would just submit to you, whether you look at a lot of record with however you carve that out with sideboards, or whether you look at a tract of record to provide some equity and relieve those people that can't meet the income test or some of these other requirements that have been established through administrative rules or through statute, that would be a major step to provide some relief to Measure 37. I think that all 36 counties would be interested in participating in a discussion with regard to that, and I would offer to you the assistance of the Association of Oregon Counties to work with you as you would look at such an effort.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Does anyone else wish to testify? And that concludes our hearing. We're adjourned.